Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Justin Blake, Executive Director of the Edelman Trust Institute. Today I'm joined by Peter Kim, a professor of management and organization at University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business. Peter has long studied the science of how relationships are built, broken, and repaired. And he's out now with a book on that subject called How Trust Works. Peter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Justin.
So you open the book talking about your family's immigration story and how it made you aware and very interested in the topic of trust. Tell our listeners more about how that serves as a foundation for your work.
Well, I started with that story for two reasons. One, to sort of underscore the nature of trust, what trust means. Formally, it's defined in my area as a willingness to make yourself vulnerable in situations involving risk. And the story of my family immigrating to the U.S. was replete with moments, many, many moments, where there was enormous risk. And so it made this issue of trust very salient. And I recount that experience to help orient readers into these issues. The other reason I bring up the story is to make clear that even though, you know, I'm a research scientist and that requires that I study this topic in an objective way, that my relationship towards trust is far from dispassionate. I have had numerous experiences with trust and its violation, just like everyone else. We all know what it's like to have our trust broken and means for our relationships, for our careers. And so that was my way of just signaling that I'm not speaking about this topic from an ivory tower. It is also informed by my personal experiences.
Can you talk a little bit more about your family experience and some of what you observed about patterns of trust breaking that got you so passionate about this topic?
The nature of an immigrant's experience is it involves meeting new people and working with new people and moving into new communities. And so there are so many moments where you need to make this decision of, do I trust the people around me? And do they trust us as new entrants into a community? There are many times in which those decisions are made incorrectly. There have been many times moving from one community to the other where it was very salient that these decisions were made not based on an assessment of who we were, for example, but through stereotypes that they might have about immigrants, newcomers to their community, the kinds of jobs my parents held, where we live in town. So those kinds of superficial indicators are often used to gauge our trust in others. And we do that all the time. As a matter of course, not only for immigrants, but in all walks of life, when we're trying to judge the trustworthiness of others, we rely on these easily available cues. What are their credentials? What degrees do they have? Where are they from? Do I know someone that is in their circle? Those kinds of cues are things we rely on all the time, but they have very little to do with the actual person, right? They are noisy indicators, and that's both a positive and a negative. Now, the positives are that it can allow us to place trust in people that we don't necessarily know very well. And that's a good thing because trust is essential for how we relate to the world, how we navigate the world, the decisions we make and cooperate with one another. At the same time, that kind of reliance is also something that can lead us astray and we can make very poor judgments of others.
So then putting aside more noisy or superficial indicators, what are some smarter ways for people to build trust or decide whether they should be putting trust, in this case, in another person?
I would start with the observation that in general, some degree of trust in others is warranted, regardless of the person. Most people operate through the world with the goal of being trustworthy. The issue is that people have very different conceptions of what that means. We all want to be good people, but what does that mean? Very few of us feel like we need to be saints. So the question is, well, okay, so what does good enough really mean to us? And that's where the rubber hits the road and where things can go awry, because different people have different understandings of what that takes. So part of what's required in these assessments is having a better understanding of what other people believe it means to be trustworthy, and also an understanding of what people need to trust. What are the expectations we have of one another? Because these expectations are often not shared. And when they're not shared, that's what sort of creates the problem.
Can you go more into the science behind it? What are some of the ways that people do enhance trust with other people?
What we know is that there are many things in society that can facilitate trust. So there are social and institutional reasons. Having a good legal system can make a big difference. Knowing that the rules and laws of a society are designed to create the incentive to be trustworthy makes a big difference. So even if you don't know anything about the other person, having a society designed so that there are the appropriate incentives, so that in many cases, it would be irrational to behave in an untrustworthy way. That's a good starting point. The other thing we know is that our beliefs about the trustworthiness of others is based on a variety of considerations. So social scientists have come up with as many as 10 different characteristics people assess when evaluating whether or not to trust someone else. And the important thing there is that the way you weigh each of those characteristics will differ depending on the kind of relationship you're in. If you are talking about a relationship with a spouse, you will weigh some of those characteristics far more heavily than others. And they will certainly differ than your trust in your doctor or a surgeon. So one of the things along those lines that we need to do when thinking about how to maintain trust is understand the nature of the relationship and what trust in that relationship really means.
In the book, you give special focus to two characteristics, competence and integrity. Can you discuss the importance of each of those and how they interplay?
Sure. Of all the characteristics people have identified as being important for trust, competence and integrity are the two most important. And that's the case regardless of the type of relationship. So whether you're assessing a coworker or a supervisor or leader or a subordinate, these have consistently been found to be the most important. Another reason why those characteristics are so important is because we weigh those characteristics very differently depending on the situation. So it turns out these odd asymmetries in our mental basement that lead us to weigh information about competence and integrity quite differently. And that's part of the problem. If I were to articulate what those asymmetries are, everyone just nods their heads. It seems almost tautologically true. And yet, even though they are far from controversial, these asymmetries, we don't account for them in how we deal with these kinds of trust situations and when we try to resolve trust violations.
Talk a little bit more about this interplay between competence and integrity.
In the domain of competence, we tend to weigh positive information about competence far more heavily than negative information about competence. So, for example, in sports, if there's a baseball player who hits a home run, everyone will see that person as a home run hitter, even though they might strike out afterwards. So that one piece of positive information is considered very diagnostic, and that strikeout afterwards is considered not very informative. That's why we weigh that positive more than the negative for competence issues. But it turns out for matters of integrity that asymmetry is reversed. We weigh negative information about integrity far more heavily than positive information about integrity. In my book, I have this example of if you cheat on your spouse and you respond after you're caught by saying, well, I didn't cheat on you yesterday, that doesn't go so well, right? So that negative piece of integrity is considered overwhelmingly diagnostic. And the fact that you didn't cheat the following day is severely discounted. It's considered meaningless. Those asymmetries are important because when we think about trust violations, the kinds of responses people can offer to address them are often double-edged in nature because they provide information about both guilt and redemption. And ultimately, our decisions about whether someone's trustworthy after a violation's happened is based on our calculus. To what extent is that guilt information more important or that information about their likelihood of redemption more important? But if we were to weigh those two considerations, and those considerations are affected by whether we're viewing the incident as a matter of competence or integrity, then that's going to really matter. So for matters of competence, if we were to think about an apology, for example, an apology is a response that conveys both guilt and repentance and the likelihood of redemption, right? So people think of apologies as a very useful thing, important thing to convey after a violation. And that's certainly true for matters of competence, because even though an apology confirms guilt, we are not going to weigh that negative information about guilt very heavily for matters of competence. We weigh negative information about competence less heavily than the positive signals of competence that an apology will convey, the desire to address this, the promise to avoid this in the future, and so on. That's where an apology is very useful for matters of competence. We consider that signal of repentance so much more important in that domain.
Are apologies quite different for matters of integrity?
So for matters of integrity, we have to go back to these asymmetries and recognize that for matters of integrity, we weigh negative information about integrity much more heavily than positive information about integrity. So if you apologize, what are you doing? If you apologize for matters of integrity, you are confirming highly diagnostic negative information about integrity. You're confirming that you lack integrity. And then you're also conveying information about repentance, that you're going to fix this in the future. But that information, that positive information about integrity is considered less meaningful. So that's a situation where an apology can actually make things worse. You are confirming you are an amoral person, someone who lacks integrity. And when you say, oh, I'm going to fix this in the future, I promise, no one's going to believe you.
So there's the make things worse. But I remember when I was reading this chapter and you gave some examples of very high profile politicians who had sexual harassment issues in the public eye, I couldn't help but think of Me Too and think of some of the powerful men who owned their behavior and apologized for the behavior and typically lost their jobs and have not found their way back, and others who didn't own their behavior. So while maybe there's a group of those that still have their jobs and in a certain way are winning, just as a human being, that doesn't actually seem like winning to me. To me, an apology feels like a very basic human an important thing is to own your behavior. So what I see is people who aren't owning their behavior, but might be keeping their jobs, et cetera.
And so this gets to, you know, a lot of what the book is trying to explore. First, that this exact same response can be effective in some situations, but not in others. A lot of my work is trying to understand that. Why would something that is virtually identical lead to such different results? A big part of the story is how these situations are being interpreted. To what extent is the situation being viewed as a matter of competence or integrity? And what are the situational features that are activating one interpretation or the other? And that's something that's as important as the response that's given, but it's something that we often aren't even aware of. It's kind of a conversation that's happening off to the side, and it's almost tantamount to driving in traffic and only looking straight ahead and not being aware of the cross traffic. And the problem there in matters of trust repair is that if you ignore that other dimension, this other battlefield, you know, there's one, the very salient one, is the person going to apologize or not? And then this other domain of dispute that's kind of implicit. Is this a matter of competence or integrity? We are often oblivious to that second dispute. We don't do as much to consider that dimension. And if we don't, then that same response that might work sometimes will actually lead to devastating results on other occasions. And the other element of this is what we're doing as perceivers. And it gets back to your point about someone's done something wrong. We would want them to apologize. That seems to be a necessary first step. And one of the implications of this work is we as perceivers are creating horrible incentives. We would imagine that across situations, the kinds of situations where we would want someone to apologize the most is after an integrity violation, after they've done something we consider completely inappropriate. But if they do offer that apology that we consider so important, we wind up hating them even more. We are punishing them and creating that disincentive for them to do what we want.
So are you saying that people should be apologizing less, institutions should be apologizing less, or are you more saying there's a smarter way to apologize that might be situation dependent?
I am certainly not suggesting that people should apologize less. So let's be clear about that. Frankly, because that kind of instrumental approach can quite often backfire. There are many instances where people deny having done something, but the evidence ultimately reveals that they are guilty. And what you have as a result, you're left with a situation where trust has not been repaired. You are just considered an untrustworthy person. So in a way, the book is trying to appeal to both sides of the equation. What do people in these situations do to try to repair trust? And one of the important things there is to really take stock of how the situation is being viewed and doing more to clarify exactly what this violation is about, so that to the extent that there are elements of competence, you didn't know, you weren't aware of these implications, those are things to make clear. You shouldn't leave that question of how the situation is being interpreted off your radar, because suddenly then you leave other people to interpret the situation for you. And so if you are trying to apologize, recognize that to the extent that you also do your best to clarify the elements of the transgression were the result of competence, that will help. The other side of the equation is, what is our role as perceivers? And I think this gets to questions of, okay, well, if matters of integrity are so devastating, in a way, we as perceivers create a situation where it's almost impossible to recover from these kinds of incidents. People do manage to redeem themselves over time. And so it's not literally impossible, but does really stack the cards against you. So one of the things the book explores is, well, what does integrity really mean? And I think this is a part of the problem that we have in society. We all have this very firm conception of what integrity is. It's defined as whether someone adheres to principles you find acceptable. But it turns out that that standard is something that can vary based on the situation, based on the person, based on culture. And so one of the appeals to perceivers is that we need to be much more conscious of those differences. Recognize that there is no universal standard that everyone subscribes to. That there are differences that good people, well-meaning people can have in terms of what should be done in certain kinds of situations. We can get into the weeds and talk about what are the foundations of this, but the essential point is to recognize those differences, recognize that decent people can have different views, so that you aren't necessarily impugning someone's integrity in ways that aren't deserved.
Another big topic in the book is truth, and truth has certainly become a surprisingly tricky topic where it feels like people can't even sometimes agree on what truth is. And you certainly made the argument that truth is foundational to the building of trust. Talk a little bit about trust and truth.
One really helpful way of thinking about truth was offered by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa after apartheid. And one of the things they did was articulate four different types of truth. The first is factual truth. What is the evidence? The second is personal truth. What is each person's view of the situation? And yet there's a third version of truth called social truth. And that kind of truth is based on the result of dialogue and debate, where people interface with one another and discuss their personal truths as well as factual truth to come up with a shared understanding of what happened. And I think that is the kind of truth that's essential for trust and for trust to be repaired. It's too easy for us to dwell on our personal truths. Social media platforms encourage that. What's missing here is that social truth, that dialogue and debate. And it's only through that dialogue that we can converge on an understanding of what happened, why it happened, and what needs to be done to address it.
So using that social truth model and thinking of the importance of dialogue and debate, let's take an important topic that we sure look at all the time in the Trust Institute and is on a lot of people's minds. Let's look at people who deny climate change. If you're trying to convince somebody that climate change is real, is there a way using dialogue and debate that you can convince them of the truth?
So that's a huge question. And I don't have a simple answer for that. A lot of times people maintain these personal truths because they're motivated to maintain those truths. And so one step that would help is to create a different kind of motivation or activate a different kind of motivation. One of those motivations might be your desire to maintain a relationship with someone who might disagree with you. And that's an element that I talk about a little bit in the book, the importance of your motivation to maintain these relationships. When you are motivated to maintain a relationship, you work harder to understand the other side's perspective. You don't necessarily reject that view because you respect that person and you believe that they are reasonable people, the people you might be debating with. And so with that motivation, let's say it's a family member who does believe in climate change that you respect, having that kind of dialogue with that person where each side really does respect the other side and wants to maintain the relationship. That's the kind of context in which some traction can be made, where you can each recognize the valid points of the other, that person that you disagree with, and try to converge on something that you can both live with. This is the social truth that is workable. It may not be perfect, but at least it'll get you closer.
And that sure indicates the counter, which is on platforms where it's so easy to just press block or unfollow, you don't have to continue that relationship.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the biggest problems with social media. You block people you disagree with, you find people who share your exact same opinion, and then it even becomes a contest to become even more extreme, to stand out. And so it's just a breeding ground for group polarization and for the kind of extremism that's so problematic.
Yeah, well, Peter, that's all that we have time for today. Thank you for the conversation. Thank you for the book and adding to the research and dialogue around trust. To our listeners, thank you for listening to The Trustmakers. If you enjoy the show, be sure to subscribe and consider taking some time to write a review. And if you're looking for more trust context and application, subscribe to the Edelman Trust Institute's newsletter via the link which you'll find in the show notes. We'll be back next time with more insights on how to build trust in today's society.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.